disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't been turned.
Welcome to This Is America, September 3rd, 2020. On this episode, first we speak with Kim Kelly, an anarchist journalist covering contemporary labor and social struggles, as well as extreme music. We speak on the current strike spreading across professional sports following the police killing of Jacob Blake. We then turn towards Kenosha, Wisconsin, where we speak to a community resident about the recent rebellion following the police killing of Jacob Blake, the role of conspiracy theories in spreading disinformation and mobilizing the far right, as well as the deadly actions of Kyle Rittenhouse that left two people dead. We then turn towards our discussion, where we touch on the recent arrest of Steve Bannon, the DNC convention, and the possibilities of Trump refusing to accept an election loss. And finally, if you value whatsgoingdown.org as a revolutionary autonomous media resource in times of crisis, and you have the means, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop to sign up to support us monthly or give us a one-time donation. You can also follow us on social media, tell a friend about us, and listen to us on Pacifica Radio. Thanks for listening. Let's get into it. Okay, back with us is Kim Kelly. It's been a while. We're going to be talking about what's happening with sports. There seems to be like a growing, what many people are referring to as a boycott, but you've been saying this is a strike. So just right off the bat, like, what is happening exactly?
Okay, so short version, with the caveat that I'm not a sports guy, not a sports journalist. I used to play sports in high school, but that's not really here nor there. But as like a labor person, I've been super interested in what's happening because essentially, I think it was Wednesday at this point, I guess game 5 of the NBA playoff, which is a big deal if you're into that kind of thing. The Milwaukee Bucks, right before they're due to go out and play the, I think it was the Orlando Magic? That might be the wrong team. That might be the right team. Again, not a sports guy. But Milwaukee Bucks, they're supposed to come out, play their game. They did not come out. And people are like, oh, what's going on? And it turns out they had decided that they were going to refuse to play. Essentially, they were calling like a wildcat strike. And that is something that spread throughout the NBA with multiple other teams deciding kind of in real time, okay, we're not going to play either. It spread to Major League Baseball with the Milwaukee Brewers. Shortly after the Bucks made their statement, they also were like, yo, we're not playing. It spread to the WNBA, who are, in terms of, you know, national sports leagues, they are always on point. They also joined in, and then they, in their little bubble, which is that all the sports teams, major league sports teams, are in these weird, super controlled environments so they can go play during a plague for reasons that are almost certainly capitalism driven, like everything. But so they came out and did like this visual protest. They were wearing shirts that had Jacob Blake's name written on the front, and they had 7 bullet holes on the back of their shirts.
Oh, wow.
Right? And these are like professional sports players with a big platform. They're coming out here being like, oh, yeah, remember that time, like a couple days ago, a cop tried to murder this man? So it was a whole thing. Even Naomi Osaka, who is this huge tennis star, she's a black woman. She came out, made a really strong statement, and she pulled out of her match that day. So we're looking at this situation where multiple players and multiple teams and multiple sports leagues, different sports, same general industry, they're refusing to go out and play, which to them is refusing to go to work. So that is a strike. In, you know, the most basic sense of the word, withholding your labor, that's a strike. Withholding your money, that's a boycott. Now, what we saw from a ton of major media sources was they're just blaring the word boycott. So-and-so is boycotting. They're boycotting. They're not boycotting. And there's, you know, there's a few schools of thought around why they picked that word. I mean, is it because not that many fancy mainstream media reporters understand things about labor? Probably. Is it because that the powers that be would rather that, you know, people, the working class in general, not really think about the idea of being able to strike. They don't want us to see, you know, these multimillionaire famous people deciding, I'm not going to work, because maybe we'll get some ideas. And then I saw another theory, which does make sense, that goes back to kind of the thorny, less sexy union side of things, where most union contracts have this thing called a no-strike clause, which is something that we usually throw in there at the end to seal the deal, keep management happy so we can, you know, get to the good stuff. So these professional sports players, they are union. Their various players associations are really powerful unions, really strong players. And in their contracts, they are not allowed to strike. That's part of the conditions of the contract. But then they did it anyway. And so calling it a boycott, in a way, gives the owners and the, you know, the people in charge, it kind of gives them some legal cover to not have to enforce that contract, because that would make them look very bad, and optics and public opinion are everything in this arena. So, all that to say, still not a boycott, definitely a strike.
Also happening at a time when general strike is a recurring hashtag that's trending on social media, too.
Oh my god, it's so hot right now.
Well, what is the... Can you explain the role of LeBron James in all this?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because he is, if you think about it, pound for pound, he is the most powerful union member in America. And he was very vocal about this. As it was going down, he was tweeting about how we need change. He's sick of it. Fuck this. And then he and his team, the Lakers, they were due to play that night. They didn't. They went into, or maybe it was the next night. Anyway, the first night all this went down, the NBA owners or whoever's in charge of that whole thing, they called a meeting for the next day, which would be the 27th, of all the players. So they had their big meeting, and the players voted on whether they were going to continue the season at all. And almost all of the teams voted that they wanted to do so. But the Lakers, which is LeBron's team, and the Clippers, who are another LA team, they voted no. So that kind of caused a whole kerfuffle, because, like, if the most famous, powerful, probably most talented dude in the NBA is like, no, I'm not playing, I'm making a statement, that fucking matters. Now, the news just came out today that during that conversation, during that vote taking, during that whole meeting that was happening, apparently Obama hit them up and had Yeah, thanks, Obama. He, like,
the wet blanket just thrown.
Honestly, yeah. And he apparently encouraged them. He encouraged them to go back to work, and to his viewpoint was, oh, you can use your platform better while you're playing. Basically, just like, all right, like, shut up and go back to work, and we'll figure it out. Which.
Or as one Fox News commenter once famously said, shut up and dribble.
Yeah. He low-key, like, in his nice way was like, no. No one wants to hear from you. Go play with your foosball. Like, it sucks. And, yeah, that just came out today. But, I mean, the fact that this happened is huge, and the fact that it's not over yet. Like, this was the Wednesday night was the big exciting, like, oh my god, everyone's on strike. But tonight, I think it was today, the Phillies, shout out to Philadelphia, they're not playing their game tonight. The NFL, which is much whiter and much more conservative than most of the other professional sports, they've been, like, not doing very much. They made some statements. They still played during the strike. Like, I don't think hockey is going to really be out here in the streets advocating for Black lives that a lot of the other leagues are going to be, just given the makeup, you know? But, yeah, I think it's something that's going to keep... We're going to keep seeing this, whether it's game postponements or cancellations or just more robust protests, because even if it was just for one night, all these players showed that they had recognized their power as workers. They'd recognized the power of withholding their labor. And hopefully they do something useful with it, you know? Like, some of these guys seem really fired up. And the Bucks... one of their players, Sterling Brown, a few years ago, he went very public with an experience he had with police brutality where a fucking cop, like, a bunch of cops were hassling him and, like, tased him and ground their knee into his neck, like the pig that killed George Floyd. Like, these dudes are mad. And hopefully now they recognize that they have this power, that collective power is the only way to really force change. Like, I'm really hoping that we see this continue and that the rest of the movement looks at this and is like, okay, well, if these rich dudes who have a lot to lose are going to be like, yo, we're not showing up for work, then what are we waiting for?
I think that's a big question, is like, what reverberation will this have in wider society? And I mean, I think that's another reason why it's so crappy to see Obama make that move, but of course not unsurprising because, I mean, obviously that's the people that are going to watch that and be excited about that are everyday working class people that like sports, you know, which is the exact same people whose lives are touched by, you know, police violence, but also the people that are largely been shut out of these, you know, electoral spectacles and like the neoliberal politics of the DNC and of course the elitist fascist politics of the RNC. So
this dumb cold water all over what if could have been a really radicalizing moment.
Yeah.
I mean, Obama in between like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and like all of these big name papers and like ESPN, like them calling it a boycott. It was really disappointing, if not unsurprising, because, like, if they had called it a strike, and then people had gone online and seen that, and maybe read more about strikes, or thought about it more, like, that could have been another crystallizing moment. But instead, by framing it as a boycott, by framing it in that same vote-with-your-dollar, consumerist-oriented, pseudo-activist kind of tag, that just kind of cut some more wind out of the sails of what could have been something really cool. But, you know, that was only, like, literally 2 days ago. So we just kind of have to keep an eye on it and see what happens.
Do you want to say anything more about this? It's definitely interesting to see this happen, you know, after everything that Colin Kaepernick has done.
Dude, deadass, this happened, the Bucks game, non-game happened 4 years to the day that Kaepernick had staged his first sit-down protest. Right? So, like, it's been a long fucking 4 years, but it's been really, like, think about the difference there, the difference in reaction, and the difference in where we're at. I feel like there's something there, you know? If he broke every owner and Republican's brain by sitting down for one game, and now we have the entire NBA being like, fuck you, stop killing us, we're not playing, that's a pretty huge leap.
Yeah. For sure.
And I guess the only other thought about the whole general strike thing, which is like almost half meme by now, which is not the best. The piece about this whole situation that corresponds with the general strike that I think is worth looking at is the fact that they got kind of close in the most basic definition, right? Because they are at different shops in different industries, if you can count each sport as an industry. Like, they got kind of close. Closer than we've seen in a while. You know, this is kind of on par with the Amazon, Instacart, Whole Food sort of coordinated actions that we saw earlier this year. Where it's like, not quite a general strike, but not that far off. Like, looking at this and seeing that kind of coordination across industries, like, that's something that the rest of us can do. And that, you know, non-millionaire workers can do, and kind of use that in our organizing strategy going forward. Because, like, you know, if baseball and basketball can get along, like, I feel a lot of us can figure things out on our end, too.
Awesome. Well, definitely encourage everybody, follow your work, follow you on social media, and always look out for your articles, which are coming out all the time. Anything else you want to say?
No, I'm just excited to... I don't know, man. I guess I'm just a sports guy now. Ooh, that's not on my 2020 bingo card, but what has been at this point, you know?
Right.
Yeah, follow me on... Oh, I mean, my boyfriend's gesturing at me to say that I'm working on a book, but I haven't started it yet, so we'll worry about that later.
Well, one thing I do want to ask before you go is, I know the pandemic is still raging, but... Is another anti-fascist metal or other extreme music festival, is that still in the cards if and when this whole thing allows us to go outside again?
We have some resources, we have some plans. This year didn't work out for a variety of reasons, but I mean, 2021 is probably going to be terrible, so I think we're probably going to need one next year. So I'll see what I can do. Stay tuned. So busy.
Okay, we're joined here today with Luigi, born and raised in Kenosha. We're going to be talking about what's been going on the ground. But before we kind of do, you know, for those that don't know, never been there, describe Kenosha. It's a city of 100,000 people, we understand. It's like the fourth largest city in Wisconsin. It seems to kind of be like a lot of towns in the Midwest, kind of like hollowed out by neoliberalism. Like one census report I read was like 50% of the people that live there like go out of town to work in the service industry. I don't know. I'm just curious if you can just kind of tell us a little bit about the city.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're pretty close on that. You're pretty spot on, pretty neoliberal. Used to be a big manufacturing town, built cars, you know, Chrysler and AMC and very working class. It's pretty split up. The poorer parts are right in the center of town, and then all around on the south side, north side, and west side are the more affluent neighborhoods.
How have things kind of changed since all the economy has shifted? You mentioned it used to be like a big industrial base. Like, what have people done since then? Just kind of moved on like everywhere else, just like service stuff or...
Yep, just like I said, like warehouse, a lot of warehouse stuff, and just some small manufacturing. There's a lot of industrial, a lot of factories and stuff still, but not huge corporations anymore really in here. So, I mean, there are, but there's Amazon and like some stuff like that, but nothing. Yeah, nothing.
Yeah, sounds very familiar. And the mayor,
Foxconn's right up the road.
Yeah, and the mayor that you have there has been there for a while, right?
He actually has been for quite some time. He was not mayor for, I don't remember how long it was, 4 years or something. He just had resigned, and then some other guy, Keith Bosman, I believe his name was, he took over for a little bit, and then the current mayor, he came back, but he has been on and off for probably 25 years or so, I'd probably say, something like that. I have no real idea. But, yeah, a long time.
For sure. Just to kind of get us started, I'm just kind of curious, you know, like, what's going through your head right now? I mean, I'm sure people there thought, I don't know, like, no one ever thinks that their town is going to be, like, the center of the attention of the entire world. I'm just curious, like, what are your thoughts, like, just out the gate right now?
It's definitely been, there's a lot of emotions, I mean, the shooting happened, the protesters that were shot happened real close to my house. It's my stepdaughter went to school with the one kid that was shot and killed. So, and there's 100,000 people here, but a lot of people know each other. So that's been crazy. And then, to see all the looting and the rioting that was happening the first couple nights, that was crazy too. We had the cops were retreating. It was wild. Yeah. It's crazy to see that stuff here because there's no real radical groups or anarchists or anything really here. You know, you got to go up to Milwaukee or to Chicago. And that's unique too about Kenosha is that it's right between those two big cities.
Well, let's talk about just kind of the initial Sunday night when the news broke. I'm just kind of curious if you just kind of want to speak to that initial wave of just kind of how it all happened. Our understanding is that it was pretty organic.
Yeah, it's all been very spontaneous too. Like the first two nights was very. You'd see different groups all over the place. It wasn't like one. It started out as like one big protest in March. It started, so when Jacob Blake was shot and the scene had started, I went down there pretty quick and the crowd was relatively small. But then the crowd kept growing and the people of color, obviously, in that neighborhood are very upset there. We went back and forth with the police for a while, and then that's when people started getting a little rowdier, started destroying cop cars, and I'm sure a lot of people, or almost everybody, has seen the cop getting hit with a brick. So yeah, and then from there, that's about where it happened, is about 3 miles from where the courthouse is. So once the crowd got big enough, and then we had all the cops had retreated because they're severely outnumbered. So they had retreated from the neighborhood, aside from whatever couple stayed there to finish the investigation. And then everybody headed towards the courthouse. We all went down there. Crowd just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And then, some people stayed at the courthouse. That's when the riot cops had come out. We're all around the courthouse. And then there's people that come and then start to break off. That's when groups go downtown. They start breaking windows and looting. And, a lot of us stayed on the line against the riot cops that night that first night was pretty wild.
I'm just curious, in terms of the looting, I feel like the way that the right talks about it is that, you know, somebody's going to come into your house and like steal your toaster and your sweatpants and stuff like that. Whereas the reality seems to be people obviously taking from stores, you know, especially corporate stores, or I'm assuming places that have insurance. I'm just curious.
There's not a lot of corporate places downtown here. They're all pretty west in the more affluent area, and the part of the city that's growing and that they care about the most. Gotcha. And then they looted the first night. They looted jewelers. They looted a couple jewelers. They broke a lot of windows. And then I'm not sure exactly what else. I know they looted a couple jewelers. And there's just like little boutiques and like stuff like that down there. So it was just a lot of broken windows. They did set fire, and then they set fire to a little store down there. They sell a lot of sports memorabilia. It's a lot of locally owned businesses down there. But the second night was the Monday was even more wild.
That's when the probation office was set on fire.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
And then before that, during the day, from our understanding, the mayor did some sort of a press conference, and then people were trying to get inside, and the police were pushing them back, and ended up like pepper spraying the crowd. I'm curious if you were aware of that situation.
I'm not sure if I heard about it. That I think I would have, but I'm not sure. Yeah, I didn't.
That was like midday or something like that. It was before.
Right. Yeah. Right. I might not have been. I don't know. Yeah, I don't recall hearing anything like that. But
the second night, was by that point, had they brought the National Guard out or other police? I'm sure that they brought more police out.
They still haven't. They still had not brought in the National Guard by then. They said, I think they did actually bring in 125. That was the first night they had brought in 125, I believe. Actually, I think the group was so big. There was a lot of people here the second night, even way more than the first night. The first night, I'd say there had to have been a good 300 to 400 people. I'd probably say the next night was probably 600 to 700, maybe more. I don't know, but there was a lot of people out that night.
What kind of things were you hearing, or what were people talking about, like, from that shift from the first night? Obviously, like, the eyes of the world were on the town on the second night, and then, you know, stuff pops off again. I'm just kind of curious, you know, like, the mood in the crowd, and, like, what kind of stuff that you heard from people going into that second night?
Well, a lot of locals are, obviously, there's a lot of liberals here, so they're very against all the rioting and stuff. So I mean, they were confronting the police, and they're angry. And then there's other groups, obviously, and there's people of color who aren't affiliated with anybody, don't have any political affiliation, but this is their neighborhood, and right. They know, they've seen all this for their entire life, and they're sick of being they're sick of being pushed and told what to do by community leaders who they haven't done much to step up either. So, you know, and then so you have two separate crowds. You have people that are going to stay there and, you know, peacefully or protest, or, you know, however you want to put it, not start too much trouble, even though there were people, even at the courthouse, they were throwing things at the police, you know what I mean? And there were garbage trucks set on fire, but that was probably, those people were the ones that went off and did, you know, the more militant stuff, right, later that night. So the second night, I had actually, instead of staying there at the courthouse and being on the front line with the riot cops, I just followed the bigger group actually broke off. And that's when we went uptown. And that's when when all the fires started and all that stuff. So yeah, there's a lot of different people out. So it's,
yeah,
a lot of people are, a lot of liberals are angry too, but, you know, in a different way, obviously.
Yeah, that's an interesting class dynamic too. I mean, well, there's a, you know, racial dynamic, which you brought up as well, but just kind of like liberals kind of coming in, and they often, because they kind of have more middle class voices, they kind of set the narrative in a lot of times. And really, the people at the center of this, like you said, are pissed, and they've lived through this stuff for a long time. And I feel like they kind of get pushed to the side because, you know, what they have to say isn't really digestible by the mainstream media.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And there's people of color in the community too who, you know, they don't want people out past curfew protesting. Mm-hmm. They want to set, you know, they want to set a goal, one goal. They, you know, they don't want to have people rioting and looting and burning the city down and, you know, all those narratives.
I'm curious your thoughts. Obviously, like, the news cycle has been, like, just dominated by the last day or so with news of this 17-year-old Blue Lives Matter militia guy, Kyle Rittenhouse. I'm just kind of curious, you know, your thoughts on everything that happened that night. and kind of what people are saying about it now that it's like really hit the eyes of the world.
Yeah, there's a lot of mixed. There's a lot of people who are celebrating him, unfortunately. And then there's a lot of people who obviously are angry too, and, you know, want him to go to prison for the rest of his life. But, it's tough. It's crazy. I don't know. The kid was a cadet. He's from like 35 minutes away from here. Mm-hmm. He's not even, you know, he's here protecting somebody's business. He doesn't even know whose business it is. You know, whatever. He's quote unquote protecting people's businesses. But yeah, that night, I guess I was actually home that night. I was trying to get some rest because I barely got some sleep those first two nights.
Yeah.
And then while the shooting, my wife was watching the live stream. I was listening to the scanner for a little bit, and then he like, you know what? She's watching the live stream. All I could hear was LRAD going off. I'm like, I want to get, I'm like, I'm going to tune out, get that sound out of my head. And then 10 minutes later, the shooting happens. So, and I'm 8 blocks from where the shooting happened. And that's right up the street from the courthouse. So that's when I went up afterwards just to see, get all, you know, see who knew what and what was going on. It was not very good.
What have people been saying? I mean, obviously there's a lot of videos that have been posted online that show the riot police like giving them water. This is the militia people and saying thanks for being out there. Are people talking about that? Or
Yeah, absolutely. Especially people. There's a lot of, from the other side too, there's manipulation of a video where, cause what had happened was people were starting argument. They were arguing with these armed guys who were claiming to be with Black Lives Matter protesters too.
Right.
They're not with the rioting, but they're with, you know, we're with you, man. They would be saying, you know, they were saying shit like that.
Right.
And then, like, I guess there was arguments starting, and some guy had a plastic, one of the guys that got shot, one of the victims, had a plastic bag with something, his belongings in it, and he threw it at the kid. And that's kind of what sparked it off, I guess. There were rumors that somebody was starting a car on fire, which I'm sure that's bogus, even though there was a car that was lit on fire there, but it was not that. It was not that the victim, he walked right up to him and shot him in the head.
Right.
And then walked to the middle, started walking away to the middle of the street. And people were, you know, hey, he shot a guy. And that's when kid with the skateboard attacked him, hit him with the skateboard. He falls, and the other almost gets his gun from him, tries to rip his gun from him. He gets it back. And he's laying on his back. He shoots the guy in the stomach, shoots the other guy in the arm, gets up, walks towards police. I'm sure people have seen that video too, where he walks towards police with his hands up. I'm pretty sure he was trying to give himself up, and all they were doing was getting him out of the road, telling him to get out of the road. And
while the crowd is screaming, he just shot somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, exactly. And just let him leave. And there was a lot of rumors the second night or the third night after the initial rioting, and there were reports of hundreds of vehicles being spotted coming to Kenosha. They're getting ready to riot and loot more, and people were just eating this. I don't know who's spreading these rumors, who's starting them, but it spread like wildfire. So there would be reports of 30 cars with blacked out license plates in a grocery store parking lot. The police would go, the cops would go check it out, and there would be nobody there. And they responded to a bunch of calls like this. And even the sheriff said that it was. So there's been a lot of rumors going around that rioters are coming. People were arrested today or yesterday. People were are here from Oregon. Riot Ribs and also Riot Kitchen are here.
These are groups that feed people, we should say.
Exactly. Exactly. They had a bus. Riot Kitchen had a bus coming that was they have converted into a food truck.
Right.
They had to stop to fill up gas cans, which they had done. They were filling up gas cans for their generator. They have nothing else. They have food. And then so there's a rumor. Now there's a rumor going around that they had the accelerant on top of the bus and that they were going to light they were going to go park the bus, light it on fire. And it was some bomb. And people are like Facebook. People
the food
on Facebook
was just a distraction for the real plan.
People are eating it up. But what they were released today, and there was video of one of the members of Riot Kitchen talking and explaining, like, no, we didn't have accelerant on our bus. You know, it's wow. Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah, every time there's something like this happens, there's you know, sometimes it takes a day or two, but the conspiracy theory grifters just move in and try to destabilize everything by like flooding social media with these conspiracy theories. And it's sad because a lot of the people that are the most impacted are not even the people that like kind of agree politically with the people that are kind of like lobbying the conspiracy theories. It's people that just are on social media and just eat that stuff up because they don't know any better.
Right.
I think another one was that the guy with the skateboard or something really had a Molotov cocktail or something I've heard. And
yeah, they had manipulated the video of right. The one guy. I don't know if it was him or the other one.
Yeah.
But yeah, they had manipulated the video of him throwing his bag of belongings to look like, or, you know, it kind of, you know, there's some, probably the light in the parking lot or something, it kind of looked like a flash of, you know, you can't right. even, it doesn't look like a Molotov cocktail.
Yeah. I mean, it's intense.
And like even the rioting that happened the first two nights, it's not, some conspiracy to just come in. It's just people of color and other people, collective anger, not taking shit anymore.
Yeah.
And then that's all it is. It's not, you know, it's not been, nobody was blacking out. There's no blacked out plates. I saw no blacked out plates. I didn't see, you know, what I saw was a lot of people who were angry.
Well, it gets people away from thinking about the real crazy stuff, like the president's saying he's going to send in troops, and we've got militia people from 45 minutes away coming here to kill people. I mean, like, if you can get people to stop talking about that and start talking about some conspiracy theory, then you've kind of won.
And aside from the, there was an office furniture store that was burnt, that was torched, and then there was a mattress store that was torched, and then it has like a Danish Brotherhood hall on the back end of it, and that building was torched. But other than that, it was the targets were pretty, you know, it was the probation office. They burnt an H&R Block building. You know, they looted a computer store and some stuff like that, a camera store, a clothing store, but they didn't set those buildings on fire. Well, they set the camera store on fire too, I believe. And it did, it displaced the family upstairs too, because there's apartments upstairs, which that, you know, that's sad, but they weren't, you know, and there's also rumors too that people are, they're coming into town to attack neighborhoods and to go to affluent neighborhoods and attack people too and attack homes. So you have, there's a subdivision called White Caps, which is west. It's pretty far west. It's almost to the interstate, which is the interstate's about 7 miles from here because we're really close to Lake Michigan. And then you have to go out about 7 miles to get to the interstate. So, you got armed militia guys or whoever, neighborhood people, whoever coming out to protect the neighborhoods from all these rioters that are coming out this night. To attack neighborhoods, which obviously was a very false claim, and then it ends up leading to protesters being murdered for no reason.
Oh, so you're saying that kind of conspiracy was what pushed them to mobilize? Because they said they had like 3,000 people that had signed up, which obviously
yeah, there's they had set up an event page on Facebook, and there was a group. There's a group that's called Kenosha Guard, and it was started by this former alderman turned private investigator who made this event to tell people to come protect our city when, you know, and their claims are completely baseless because nobody was coming to attack neighborhoods. Do you ever see anybody attack neighborhoods when they're rioting?
No. The only time we've heard of even that kind of like language, specifically of like neighborhoods, which, or suburbs, which is always kind of like coded for like kind of like wealthier white people or something like that.
Right.
That's been pushed by literally like far right groups online, and they've actually tracked this in that they found like those groups are pushing that just to kind of like in this situation, right, destabilize or like rile up like Trump supporters and militia types who don't know any better or do know, and they kind of feed off that fear so they can.
Exactly. And the guy who started that group actually came out today and said that he stands by his call to arms and all this. So yeah, he's culpable. That's how I feel.
Yeah. And like there was a meme that was posted in that group that we took a screenshot of and we shared it. And it's, you know, it's some stupid thing where it's like some like soldier from some video game. He's like smoking a cigarette. He's got all these guns on him. And it said, it was something about like BLM and Antifa or whatever. But it was basically just like celebrating violence. Like, you know, we're going to get you. And
right.
They just have like such a cartoon fantasy of like what's going on. They're so removed from the reality. And I don't know. It's so weird also to see them kind of like cloak all that in like, you know, we're here for the community. Like, we support Black Lives Matter, but we're going to post this meme about killing you. You know, just like,
yeah, like, and that's the protesters. Nobody was fooled by it either. You know, yeah. Everybody was out there like, you're full of shit. There was one guy who told he was trying to protect a gas station, and he was telling them, you're not with us. If you were with us, you wouldn't be protecting this gas station. You'd be out here.
Or at least put your gun away and then have a conversation or get to know people.
Right.
I mean, don't show up and be like, you know, we're the new police force. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Well, what's going through people's heads right now? Are there National Guard troops on the ground? Like, are protests still happening? I'm just kind of curious where things are at right now.
There are. Actually, it's gotten pretty quiet the last few nights. There has been a crowd at Civic Park, which is right across the street from the courthouse. There's a group every night. It's getting smaller. It's definitely been very calm the last couple nights, other than feds. The feds are here and they're snatching people up. There was 36 arrests last night. I'm not sure.
These are arrests connected to supposedly crimes that have been committed.
Curfew. This is just curfew and people that are leaving the protest. They've been snatching them up and bringing them to jail, and it's just intimidation is all it is.
Wait, so you're saying that federal authorities are these like DHS or?
I have no idea.
But stuff like what was happening in Portland, they're
blacked out. Yeah, black SUVs, and they're just snatching people up and arresting them, and like the woman I spoke to today, and we re-recorded it too. She had just been released. She was with Riot Kitchen. There were ones that were arrested. Lost my train of thought here. What were we talking about again?
Well, I'm just curious because, I mean, like Trump basically said, like, we're going to send in, you know, like we did in Portland, we're going to send in these DHS people, which is like a collection of like border patrol.
Yeah, no, well, she said she had lost her keys, her wallet, and then when they released her, they told her they couldn't do anything about it because they were not the ones that brought her in. So it wasn't local police. So she had no idea who it was.
But this is not in the context of them like stopping any sort of like illegal activity. This is just either you're out past curfew or they're just like finding people leaving the protest. You're saying,
pure
intimidation, basically, like you said.
Exactly. Yeah, there is nothing to charge. There's nothing going on other than being in the park. past curfew.
Which protest. Again,
that's all they're doing is standing there in the park these last two nights. Riot Ribs is there cooking. You know, there was water bottles being thrown, you know, at the Bearcats and Caps and Riot gear. Like, you know, that's not, so they didn't use tear gas or anything last night like they did the couple nights before, but they pushed everybody out of the park still.
That just makes what happened with Kyle Rittenhouse even more disgusting because, of course, those people were out past curfew.
Exactly. After I had gotten to the scene of the shooting, there is a parking lot that is adjacent to this. It was a used car lot that was converted from it used to be a gas station. Now it's a used car lot. So there's another lot across the street to the south that's for an apartment building and the hospital. I think the hospital uses it. The hospital's right across the street. So there's protesters in that parking lot, some vehicles, some protesters had vehicles, some on foot. There's riot cops. There's a line of riot cops. They're shooting pepper bullets and trying to get people to clear the area. All the meanwhile, there's pickup trucks. There's at least two or three pickup trucks that drive into the parking lot of the used car lot, armed militia guys. And these guys don't get fired on. They don't get told to leave. It was really, really weird.
Well, hey, we really appreciate you coming on. Is there anything you want to go over that we didn't get a chance to talk to or anything else you want to say?
No, thank you, man. I just hope it keeps going. We can't lose momentum. It has those first couple nights were, to me, were pretty inspiring, and we just got to keep going. We can't stop.
Well, awesome. Well, I appreciate you coming on and give us a window into a very volatile situation. We hope you stay safe out there, you and your family and everybody else.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Friends. Seen a whole lot of people want bands. Seen a whole lot of people can't get what they want, so a whole lot of people pop bands. They say the means don't justify the ends. Did the ends ever justify the means? And will we end all of this hardship if we just put rich pickers in the guillotine? Really? Oh, cigar rolls blows on the war field. Whole world torn, but I'm more chill. Told the doc I don't need more pills. I need more Skrilla, not more bills. And that ain't even me trying to get fly. That's just really Reed trying to get by. Everybody want to live a good life. Even when we caught up in a hood ride. Some be bopping like it's slow-mo. Some be mobbing with the fofo. Some be sitting try to meditate. Some don't walk cause they levitate. Some don't hawk, just elevate. Some don't talk cause they hella fit. Some don't stop but still ever shine. Play the back when in the moon time. Fade to black then it's goon time. Blaze the track and it's a new rhyme. You got passion, it's in due time. Same glasses with some new wine. You've been asking but you do know. Without actions how can you grow? I see you pushing out the concrete. Did you ever know your roots are deep? I'm so proud of myself, it's just how I feel. I do my dance all in the mirror because I am real. And everybody want the negative, I wanna chill. All of this shit that I've been through that turned me to steel. And I'm so focused right now, we're playing no games. I have been through all the sorrow and tasted the pain. Enemies trying to stop me, I won't say their names. I won't give them the fame, I put two in their frame. Seen a whole lot of people want friends. Seen a whole lot of people want bands. Seen a whole lot of people can't get what they want, so a whole lot of people bob dance. They say the means don't justify the ends. Do the ends ever justify the means? And will we end all of this hardship if we just put rich pickers in the guillotine? Really? Oh, cigar rolls blows on the war field. Whole world torn, but I'm more chill. Told the doc I don't need more pills. I need more Skrilla, not more bills. And that ain't even me trying to get fly. That's just really Reed trying to get by. Everybody want to live a good life. Even when we caught up in a hood ride. Some be bopping like it's slow-mo. Some be mobbing with the fofo. Some be sitting try to meditate. Some don't walk cause they levitate. Some don't hawk, just elevate. Some don't talk cause they hella fit. Sun don't stop but still ever shine. Play the back when in the moon time. Fade to black then it's goon time. Blaze the track and it's a new rhyme. You got passion, it's in due time. Same glasses with some new wine. You've been asking but you do know. Without actions how can you grow? I see you pushing out the concrete. Did you ever know your roots RD? I'm so proud of myself, it's just how I feel. I do my dance all in the mirror because I am real. And everybody want the negative, I wanna chill. All of this shit that I've been through done turned me to steel. And I'm so focused right now, we're playing no games. I have been through all the sorrow and tasted the pain. Enemies trying to stop me, I won't say their names. I won't give them the fame, I'll put two in their frame.
For those of you that don't know, that haven't heard the story yet, you might remember the We Built the Wall campaign, which was a big GoFundMe campaign, which happened maybe a year and a half to 2 years ago. And it was run by a guy named Brian Colfage. And Brian Colfage is pretty notorious, even amongst people on the right wing, for running GoFundMe campaigns and then just like running away with the money. And he's done this a number of times. And so when he started the We Built the Wall campaign, some people raised concerns about his involvement. And so people like Chris Kobach and Steve Bannon got involved and became members of the, quote, board of We Built the Wall. And they raised a bunch of money and so far have built like 30 yards of border fence on like someone's property that's set off like a half a mile from the actual border. And then we're told by Customs and Border Protection to just like stop. But apparently the reason that they haven't built more of the border wall is that all the money got stolen. And the way the money got stolen is actually really fascinating. So people like Bannon set up tons and tons and tons of shell organizations, right? It's a real easy way to like hide money. It's a real easy way to sort of take money from one place and funnel it to another place. I mean, even like, quote, community development nonprofits, like nonprofits which engage in gentrification, are widely known to do this kind of thing with, you know, community development block grant money and things like that. And they pass it through these kind of shell funds and back to real estate developers, right? So this is a pretty common practice. But what they did in this case is they told people on the GoFundMe page that every single dollar that was raised was going to go to building the border wall. And people donated money based on that idea. Then what happened is that Brian Colfage needed an organization to take the money from the GoFundMe so he didn't have to pay personal income tax on a couple million dollars in money that they raised. And so Steve Bannon used some nonprofit that he runs, which is, you know, doesn't really have any employees or any programs. It's just a nonprofit on paper, to take that money in. And then he gave himself like $325,000 of that money for personal living expenses and gave Brian Colfage an original, like a first payment of $100,000 and then $20,000 a month. And so that is money laundering. I mean, they made a verbal agreement with people that were donating to the fund, that they wouldn't use that money for their own purposes. And then in order to use the money for their own purposes, they laundered the money through a series of shell nonprofits to do that. That is literally textbook money laundering. So yeah, Steve Bannon might go to prison. I guess it depends on how many people he decides to roll on now that he's actually in jail, which, you know, he's got a lot of information that I'm sure a lot of people would want to know. So we'll see where this goes. It's going to get interesting.
You know, again, I really encourage people, if you have access to it, if you can find it, there's a documentary about Steve Bannon on Hulu. I can't remember the name right now, but if you just search for it, Steve Bannon documentary, it covers the time after the 2018 midterms up until I think maybe the end of 2019 or something like that. It's a fascinating and very scary documentary. It shows two things I think that are big takeaways about Bannon. One is that he has some big financial backers outside of the Mercers. The Mercers kind of turned on him and just said, you know, you're too close to these alt-right people. You know, you're too close to Milo. We don't want to work with you. So they cut him off. But remember, you know, as he's totally not a globalist elite, he used to work at Goldman Sachs, which is this huge financial conglomerate. But basically, after he left there and started to, like, make movies and stuff, which, I mean, again, if you want, like, to just watch a film to kind of get in his head, I really suggest watching, I think it's, like, Generation Zero. Or,
yeah, get really, like, prepare yourself for that one. It's quite a ride.
Yeah, it's based around this idea of the fourth turning, that every, like, four generations, there's, like, a new turning. And I mean, it's filled with some gems, like, you know, the 60s were really about just, like, privileged children revolting against, like, how good it was. And, you know, this utopia that was America, and they're the reason, basically, that things are messed up. And then, you know, that created globalization, which, you know, led to the Democrats and so on and so forth. And finally, we have Trump. I mean, it's almost kind of like a QAnonian kind of a look at the world. But basically, it ends with kind of like arguing that, you know, the love of the state and kind of like, you know, an American ethos needs to be reinscribed to the lost generation of people whose lives have been hollowed out by globalization and immigration and so on and so forth. And the best way to do that is probably through a war with China or something like that. So it's a very Bannian presentation. Definitely a very interesting look into his worldview. But again, like, if you watch this other documentary that's about Steve Bannon, again, it shows him palling around with people from Goldman Sachs and, like, other big financial institutions that are funding his activities. And what he's doing is creating this thing called the movement, which is essentially taking kind of the strategy that he used in the U.S., which is building coalitions of different groups. So in the U.S., like with the buildup to the Trump election in 2016, you know, he was working with lots of, like, online communities trying to, like, weaponize, like, the alt-right or even incels and different stuff that's come out to, like, to go hard for Trump online, but also trying to bring in, like, evangelicals and other different parts of kind of the Republican coalition to back Trump. And what he's doing in Europe is working with a lot of far-right and nationalist parties and even what, you know, we would call white nationalist or neo-fascist parties. So, for instance, there's one scene where he's sitting down with, like, I think it's, like, Mussolini's, like, granddaughter or something like that. And they get in an argument because the journalist is saying, like, yeah, so he, like, introduced you to us as, like, this fascist party. And she's like, oh, we are not the fascist party. And, I mean, there's other shots where, like, literally there's, like, Republican officials sitting in a room talking with people that are part of the Swedish Democrats, which are,
you know, a far right-wing party. Yeah.
Well, not only a far right-wing party, but, you know, a white nationalist party. I mean, maybe they've kind of, like, tried to clean up their image a little bit, but definitely people that believe in, like, racial, like, you know, fascist identity politics. But again, I mean, it's very scary. I mean, it shows just, you know, kind of like what he's been doing in the U.S., but on a global scale. I mean, obviously, he's got some issues going on because he's getting arrested on a fucking yacht. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, for all of Steve Bannon's faults, I mean, he's definitely, like, a huge global player and somebody with, you know, very scary. I mean, he's, you know, the same guy that gave a speech in Rome, you know, quoting, you know, Evola.
Well, and he's got connections to the Catholic Church, too. So, I mean, people have heard about Tradcaths, I'm sure, at this point, like traditionalist Catholics, right? And there's been kind of this turn amongst elements of the alt-right into becoming traditionalist Catholics. It has a lot to do with, like, the authoritarian structure of the Catholic Church and trying to valorize that and so on. So it's really weird. But a few high-ranking kind of Catholic bishops and archbishops in the United States are really deeply embedded in the traditionalist Catholic sort of ethos and kind of community. And Bannon is connected to them. So there's been this story for a while about Steve Bannon essentially building a fascist training school in an old monastery in Italy. And that, so originally he had sort of convinced the Catholic Church that what he was doing was running a sort of religious education school. And then they realized that that's not what he was doing, so they told him he couldn't use the monastery anymore, but then he bought another one. And so there's this whole training school that he's trying to get up and going with the help of right-wing elements of the Catholic Church in Italy right now. And those right-wing elements of the Catholic Church are deeply, deeply, deeply tied to elements of the Catholic Church in the United States, which, I mean, the Catholic Church has always been an incredibly problematic institution, but in the U.S. right now is more or less limited to people that are okay with homophobia, right, and racism and, you know, shielding child predators. But yeah, I mean, he's deeply, deeply, deeply connected in ways that I think are still yet to be understood.
I think also what's fascinating about Bannon is that it shows that there are segments of the elites that are very much invested in funneling money towards those type of politics. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we're kind of used to looking at the world of kind of like geopolitics as like just like baseline neoliberal. You know, which there's a lot of truth in that, but there's also people that have pretty far right wing ideas and they're willing to take their money, you know, that they've made and funnel it towards people like Bannon. I mean, this is like, you know, historically what's happened. I mean, you've had people like, you know, Henry Ford, for instance, in the U.S. But it's important to keep in mind. But yeah, let's move on to the DNC first.
The DNC is actually kind of interesting because there's been this big shift in the way that Democrats talk about politics. So if we rewind back to, say, 2008, right, when Barack Obama is running against John McCain, that election was largely an election about policy, right? You had two people who were having, you know, friendly disagreements about policy, right? And yeah, McCain choosing Sarah Palin did definitely change things and definitely indicated that there was a shift coming, right? And that was really the moment where the weird wing nutty part of the far right really got into mainstream politics, was when Sarah Palin was chosen as vice presidential candidate. I mean, even myself and you know, I followed politics just as closely back then as I do now, had no idea who she was. Right. But now that it's kind of entrenched itself in the Republican Party, what you can see over time is that the degree to which politicians actually talk about things that are concrete has vanished. And the last election was an interesting example of that, right? You had one candidate, Hillary Clinton, who I agree with about nothing, but was articulating concrete ideas about what she felt she wanted to impose in our lives, right? And then you had Trump, who didn't talk about anything concrete at all. He just moved from like hyperbolic statement to hyperbolic statement to slogans to blah, 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 blah. And there were no real concrete plans. And, you know, the general knowledge in 2016 was, well, that's going to mean he loses, right? Because the political press had just assumed that what Americans wanted to hear was how politicians were going to fix problems, right? And instead, what they got was they got one person who was talking about that and one person who was like braying loudly on the stage in guttural tones with a big red hat on. Right. And that's the person who won. And it kind of threw the entire political press for a loop. No one really knew what to make of that. It flew in the face of everything that political science professors have been teaching their students, everything that journalism professors have been teaching their students for decades. Right. And decades of American history. So now what's going on is that the Democrats have now embraced this new reality. And the DNC is really fascinating because, yeah, you've got Elizabeth Warren like talking about policy stuff. But generally, the entire DNC, the entire convention has been grounded in going after Donald Trump as a human. Right. And so the narrative that's being spun right now is, look at Donald Trump. He's so scared of the American public that he had to hide in his bunker while people were getting tear gassed outside the White House. Look at Donald Trump. He's so incompetent that he can't deal with, you know, handling a pandemic. Look at Donald Trump. He's so dumb that he doesn't understand that, like, the U.S. pulling out of Syria is going to damage our global position, right? So on, so on, so on. And they're talking about it in these very personal terms, right? Even Barack Obama, the speech he gave was, I mean, the kind of big punchline joke of the whole thing was him saying, you know, Trump can't rise to the occasion because he's too busy trying to, you know, run a reality TV show. And what that technique is actually a technique that they're stealing from the Lincoln Project. So for those of you that have been following the Lincoln Project, who, again, there is nothing about their politics to really be excited about at all. They are centrist Republicans, right? They are doing this in an attempt to gain control of the Republican Party. I think that that's incredibly transparent. But you have to admit, they make a good internet ad. And the internet ads that they've been making directly target Trump's psyche in really fascinating ways. So, for example, they made an ad. It was like a 45-second long ad. They played it on Fox News during shows that they know he watches, which ran through all of the people in his inner circle that have snitched on him and then or leaked information, and then ended with, "Donald, if you can't trust your inner circle, who can you trust?" Right. And it was directly meant to play on his sense of paranoia. Those kinds of ads generate a response from him. And so what we've been seeing is that during Kamala Harris's speech or during Barack Obama's speech, he was tweeting in all caps, just like nonsense the whole time. And he looks like a fool, and he looks like he's weak, and he looks like he's trying to hold on to something that isn't there anymore. Because what I think the Democrats have realized is that most Americans don't actually care about economic policy. Like, they don't know enough to be able to tell the difference, right? Most Americans don't actually understand foreign policy, right? I mean, we knew this when we went to war in Iraq, and most Americans couldn't even point it out on a map, right? That what Americans respond to is hyperbole. And Americans respond to anger, and Americans respond to rage. And the right wing has very much embraced that kind of a politics. And what we're watching is we're watching the Democrats do the same thing. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. I think that it's going to be really fascinating to watch how that plays out in the years to come, because what could be going on here is this sort of retreat from any sort of material discussion. And this sort of retreat into these sort of points of momentary discursive novelty, where they're essentially just running pure marketing campaigns and not even trying to shield that anymore. I mean, we all know that political campaigns are just commercials, right? I mean, they're just marketing campaigns with target audiences and target audience analysis and all this stuff. But at least there was the attempt for a long time from people in both parties to engage in serious political conversation. And it seems like everyone has just abandoned that now. So who knows what that's going to lead to, but it's a really fascinating shift. What we can tell is that Trump is pissed, and it's really, really, really funny to watch him react angrily in real time on Twitter to all these things and to just watch him get mocked. You know, and what he does in these moments is he tries to react against a bunch of other stuff, right? So, I mean, just yesterday, he apparently came across a news story from a local TV station in Kansas, which was running a news story about Goodyear tire plants and how Goodyear Tire had banned any political advertising unless that advertising or T-shirts or hats or whatever had to do with racial justice or LGBT rights. And Trump freaked out because to him, that's like censorship, right? And so he started like talking crap about Goodyear Tire on the internet yesterday. And what that led to was all of these people from Akron, Ohio, including the city's official Twitter account, trolling him last night. LeBron James chiming in at various points because LeBron James grew up in Akron, Ohio, right? And so he's picking a fight with a medium-sized Rust Belt city whose sole industry is the tire industry and has been for like 120 years. What is particularly ironic about that is that the Kevlar-reinforced tires on the presidential limo are made by Goodyear. And so, of course, they tweeted that, or the city of Akron tweeted that. And so he responded, "Well, maybe I'll have to get new tires." And what they're doing is they're putting him in this mental state where they're pushing him away from being able to focus on anything concrete. And it's creating a lot of chaos in his campaign. What that chaos will add up to, I'm not sure. But what we've seen so far is that the Trump campaign has been entirely incoherent. Like, they have yet to have a coherent campaign strategy that they can stick to, right? They tried going after Hunter Biden, right? That didn't work because, you know, Hunter Biden's not running for office. Then they tried going after Barack Obama, but that doesn't work because Obama's not the president anymore. Then they tried to, you know, attach the Democrats to Black Lives Matter, but that doesn't really work because a lot of BLM organizers aren't too fond of the Democrats, right? And are very open about that. Then they tried to go the Kamala Harris birtherism route, which was racist and absurd. And now they're doubling back onto Hunter Biden. Like, the ad that they just released today has to do with Hunter Biden, who, again, not the person who's running for office. And so they have yet to present a coherent campaign strategy. And we're like 2.5 months away from the election. And so what it looks like is this strategy that the Democrats are using is actually really effective. It's throwing him off balance and is making him have to act in super reactionary ways. Had enough of a consistency that he's not able to really find his footing and move forward on anything, right? So he's doing all these things to try and distract attention. For example, he announced that they're going to start drilling for oil in the Alaska Wildlife Nature Preserve, right, in Anwar, which, you know, environmentalists have been trying to fight that for 20 years. Why would you declare that? He can't even declare that. Like, that's a Department of the Interior decision, which would have to go through Congress. You'd have to reclassify that land. Well, he's saying that because he's hoping that's going to change the news cycle. But what's happening right now is the entire news cycle is now based on the fact that the DNC is exactly what everybody expected it to be. And Trump's reaction is exactly what people expected it to be. And so it's confirming a lot of people's assumptions about him. And so moving forward, the more that they continue the strategy, the more unhinged he seems. And the more that that chips away at his ability to attract any new support. Because keep in mind, we're running the election right now is pretty much broken down to the 40 or so percent people who will vote for Trump under any circumstances and the 60% or so that will vote against him under any circumstances. There are very few people that are undecided and very few people are voting for Joe Biden. Almost nobody is voting for Joe Biden. Nobody cares. Everyone's voting against Donald Trump, right? And so the more that they can make Trump essentially run against himself, which is kind of the strategy here, the more that they're going to chip away at his ability to gain any more support. Now, we all know, and Kayleigh McEnany, the White House press secretary, essentially admitted to this at a press conference just a day ago, but Trump is going to refuse to acknowledge any election results that result in him not winning. I think that that was plainly obvious for anyone to see. You know, we've been talking about that on this show and on the website for the better part of a month now, and what that means. But we know that that's going to happen, but it got confirmed from the podium during a press conference in the White House. And so what it seems like the Democrats' strategy is to delegitimize him as much as possible, run up the score on the election as much as possible to undermine his argument that the election was stolen. Now, what that's going to lead to is unclear because at the end of the day, if he's not going to leave office, he's not going to leave office. And there's little that you can do legislatively to really change that. That's going to have to happen from action on the streets. Right. But it seems like what the Democrats are doing is they're priming people for that, like not necessarily massive confrontational protests, but they're priming people to be able to react from a position of firm certainty. When he refuses to acknowledge the results of the election, what that does is it makes it a lot less likely that he's going to be able to successfully carry that forward. And increasingly, what it looks like at this point is that he's going to refuse to acknowledge the results of the election, and then we'll negotiate some sort of process right of leaving office.
Right. I want to make a couple points on the DNC too. You know, again, there's. You look at a lot of the things that are being said, you know, everything from like the BLM blocks in the back of, you know, Elizabeth Warren's talk to, you know, obviously like people like AOC or Bernie Sanders. You know, again, like we've said this a lot, but I mean, this is the recuperation of social movements. Yep. I mean, this is like people talking about, you know, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, like literally 10 years after that social movement, like first developed, as if people making $15 an hour now is like some sort of even livable wage. You know, the inclusion of George Floyd's parents, you know, on the same panel as like police chiefs and like other bureaucrats and stuff like that, which are like have no interest in like, you know, acquiescing to even minimal demands. You know, again, like we got to call it for what it is. This is recuperation. This is like, you know, invoking the spirit of these movements that this political party is like deeply, deeply opposed to.
Yeah, well, and they do this all the time. I mean, if you if you really look at the structure of the Democratic Party, we have totally said this before. So, like, anyone that's been listening to this show for a long time is probably like, yeah, I already know what they're going to say. But if you look at the structure of the Democratic Party, starting in the late 1960s and moving into the 70s, or really kind of starting after the Civil Rights Movement, the Democratic Party has been a structure through which the moderate elements of social movements are valorized. Right, that they're brought into power, that they're given their moderate concessions, and they're allowed to claim legitimacy from that. Right, what that means is that the Democrats are a really critical piece of the counterinsurgency strategies that get used in the United States to prevent radical political initiatives from gaining traction. Right,
but I mean, they're doing it in a certain way. You know, it's just like if you look at like Ted Wheeler's Twitter page or Kamala Harris, like they're like now putting their pronouns on there and stuff like that. So it's like this very like you know aesthetic kind of like presentational approach. It has nothing to do with like, you know, we want the world to be different or even just like in terms of policy. And somebody, I was listening to some interview recently, I don't know who it was, and they pointed this out, but I mean, you know, if you look at like the Democratic Party line now, or at least like the rhetoric that they use, I mean, they are running against themselves, you know, in the from the 1990s. I mean, and again, like, you know, it was the Clintons that really pushed like this alliance with Silicon Valley and kind of this new breed of donor class. You know, they pushed, you know, NAFTA, globalization. They pushed, you know, mass incarceration. Obviously, you know, Biden had a huge part of the, you know, the Biden crime bill that was about allocating massive amounts of money towards police departments, about upping the war on drugs, an expansive foreign policy that led to, you know, actions in the Middle East. I mean, look at Hillary Clinton's role in the coup in Honduras, where, you know, people are now fleeing that country to try to come to the United States. I mean, again, this is by and large not even talked about, not even on, you know, the wider left. But I think the other point, too, is that these policies helped make Trump. I mean, when you have decades of corporate globalization and offshoring and automation, and you have all these people that before, you know, had some sort of working class, you know, level of existence that was tied into their jobs, and now that's gone, and now production is totally shifted, and they're totally left behind, just like, you know, largely communities of color have been left behind. You know, they're looking for somebody to help them out, and when you have somebody like Trump that knows on one hand that he can point towards these policies and say, like, I'm going to do something about it, even though obviously he hasn't done anything about it. In fact, it's even gotten worse under Trump. I mean, a lot of people went for that. And again, I think the other point to make is that the Democrats obviously have no policies or even like ideas about what to do about these problems. As you said, they're essentially just running against Trump and, you know, how bad it's gotten. Yeah. And I think that this is something that's like very much benefited them, is that, you know, I remember even like one ad that was like from the midterms a couple years ago that was like, it was just a sticker that said, "Have you seen the other guy?"
Yeah, well, and they're running on this whole Donald Trump is an existential threat to American democracy line, which is not false necessarily. But what they're doing is they're kind of co-opting the language of people that have been in the streets this entire time, right? Who have been raising this alarm forever, right? Just like every Democrat now will talk about how they're against Nazis and stuff, because it damages the Trump administration. But yet we were screaming about how dangerous the far right was. I mean, we've been screaming about that for 25, 30 years already, right? A lot of us. And they never gave, you know, they never cared at all about what we were saying. And so when we see the Democrats doing this, I think we have to keep in mind that their kind of ability to discover these sorts of organic practices that happen in radical communities and then co-opt them is a long practice technique that they've been utilizing ever since like the mid to late 1960s, right? I mean, people like James Clyburn, Senator James Clyburn, who was a civil rights organizer, was very moderate in the civil rights movement, right? John Lewis was very moderate by the standards of the civil rights movement. People in the civil rights movement were talking about things like police abolition, right? They were talking about things like Black community autonomy, right? They were talking about all of those things. But these moderate elements that were coming out of initially Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and then the NAACP, we're very specifically trying to shove all that back into the legislative process, right? We just watched the same thing happen with, quote, defunding the police. That all of these groups started really pushing to abolish the police in their cities, right? And what happened was that Democrats started getting involved and going, hey, cool, we're interested in that, but, you know, you have to do that through budget. So instead of protesting, you should start coming to these budgetary hearings. And they pushed it into the legislative process. And then what they could say is, all of those people out on the street, you know, we can feel what they're saying, but they're being reckless, right? And that justifies the crackdowns. And so whenever we run into a situation like this, and I remember very, very, very clearly 2004, where the same conversation was happening about George W. Bush, there is a tendency amongst radicals to forget their radicalism in moments like this. And they show up and they not only vote against the guy that they're trying to get rid of, they do it enthusiastically. And they vote enthusiastically for somebody else. They go campaign for that other person. And all of our energy gets sucked into the Democratic Party. And that's what keeps the Democratic Party going, literally. You know, we can see the same thing with the DSA, right? And splits in the DSA between elements of the DSA that are like, yes, our only path to socialism is through the electoral process, and parts of the DSA that want nothing to do with that. Those are mutually exclusive positions, right? But so what's happening now is that they're trying to get as many people as possible to show up to vote against Trump and not particularly think too hard about who they're supporting. Right. There's almost been no discussion about why anyone would vote for Joe Biden or why anyone would want Democrats in charge, because the people that they're trying to attract to show up in November are not people that agree with the Democratic Party. They're people that are actually very far outside of the Democratic Party, most of them. But they're trying to get them to show up and cast at least a ballot. Right. But the reality is that everybody that's going to take that tactic needs to keep in mind that at the end of this, there needs to be accountability for what the Democrats have done, right? Democratic mayors have been responsible for tear gassing crowds. Democratic mayors have been responsible for extreme police repression. Democratic mayors are allowing feds to come into their cities under Operation Legend, right? That all of that is happening in Democratic cities, right? And most of the major demonstrations that were repressed really violently happened in Democratic cities. And so, yeah, they can, you know, have blocks that spell out BLM in the background of their speeches. But at the end of the day, they have to take responsibility for injuring and arresting thousands of people, because that blood is on their hands. And so as we're starting to really think about what's happening in this election, we really have to be talking openly about how essentially we are choosing between Donald Trump, who is awful and dangerous, right? And Democrats, who are potentially slightly less awful and less dangerous. But what we're not doing is we're not choosing between Donald Trump, who is horrendous, and saviors, right? That these people are not going to save us. These people have no interest in what we're fighting for, none. And they're not allies in that struggle. We always need to be very clear on that point.
Well, I think this is where the kind of idea that I've been seeing a lot in a lot of lefty progressive circles of, hey, we're going to push this administration to the left is, I think it's like ahistorical. I mean, there's been, and dangerous in a lot of ways, because what it's saying is that we need to basically focus not on building up, you know, different forms of life, you know, material infrastructure, or building social movements which can actually do things. What we need to do is somehow influence these politicians, which, I mean, look, Joe Biden's been around for like decades. He's a career politician. You don't think he's been influenced, you know, at all? Like suddenly he's going to like be pushed in a certain direction? Or, you know, Kamala Harris, it's like, come on, what, how are you going to push these people and like, and what vehicle are you going to do that, that somehow corporate lobbyists don't also have access to, or, you know, police unions or other people? I mean, they've already come out against, you know, the idea of even like defunding the police.
Yeah.
They've already come out
against, wants to give more money to the police under his like police reform bill that he's pushing as part of his policy
proposals. Yeah, they're already on paper as opposing any sort of the just the baseline level progressive kind of like demands, like, mm-hmm. you know, universal health care, you know, defunding the military and the police, you know, debt forgiveness, you know, so on and so forth. I mean, they're opposed to all these things. Again, yes. Like you said, the only thing they're running on is, you know, we're not Donald Trump. And I don't know, I just think that we need to remember that and kind of like really critique the people on the left that are really saying like this is the way forward. I've seen a lot of articles saying like, oh, Kamala Harris is like the most progressive prosecutor in the world, like this is our chance. I mean, I would encourage people, you know, if you want kind of a vision of this, look up, there was an episode of Glenn Beck's show where he had somebody from the Communist Party USA. And this is like, the Communist Party USA is like the Communist Party in the United States that like back in the 30s was like sizably large. And yeah. Now it just produces like basically a newspaper. Mm-hmm. But they came out very strongly in favor of Obama. And they had this whole line about, you know, Obama was a former community organizer. He's going to do all this stuff. Like, he's the most progressive candidate. I mean, if you weren't around back then, I think it's hard to like, to kind of like understand that there was like a progressive buzz around Obama, just yeah. like there was around, you know, Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. maybe not in the same way. And a lot of it was, is that, oh, he's an African-American candidate. Everything's going to change magically once he gets into office, so on and so forth. But I mean, there was like a lot of like energy from the left to elect Obama. And anyway, Glenn Beck basically sits down, and of course, it's all like a gotcha type interview. He wants him to be like, oh yeah, Obama wants the same thing that we do, you know, therefore Obama's a communist, blah, blah, blah. But it just kind of shows you just kind of like how deluded a lot of the left was, and so much of their hopes were put in this administration that it was going to change, or that it would like listen to, you know, the social movements or people on the ground. Again, like, you know, where is the evidence of that? And also too, like, where there is evidence of that happening, either of the Democrats like buckling or responding to pressure, that's because of people organizing and doing stuff in yes. the streets. So yes. if you actually want to be in a position of like pushing politics, at least on a state level, then you would actually not focus on like, you know, influencing the state. I mean, I don't understand what that actually means. To me, it just, when people say that, what they mean is usually just like shut up and let the process work and hope for the best. Mm-hmm. Cause I mean, that's what I see people doing when they say that. And just like being excited and hoping that things are going to work out as, you know, our planet is on fire and just continues yeah. towards like some, you know, horrible end game. Yeah, instead of doing that, let's actually focus on what we have been doing, which is building our own power outside of the state.
Well, and that leads to the other weakness in this strategy, right? So usually politicians derive their mandate, right? What's called in political science a mandate, or their legitimacy, right, in other terms, from the fact that people support them. And what's going on right now is there are very few people. I mean, I live in a deep blue area, and there's definitely Biden signs up, right? There's actually kind of a lot of them. But not as many as you would imagine. Definitely not as many as there were Sanders signs, just, you know, even just 6 months ago. And what that indicates is that, you know, when Joe Biden, if Joe Biden gets elected, and that's looking more and more like the case, or if Joe Biden wins the election, right? Which is looking more and more the case, he's not necessarily going to have that mandate because people aren't voting for him. Right. The Democrats are running this entire campaign against Trump, and they're not running this campaign for Biden. And what that means is that Biden's going to enter office in sort of a politically weak position. Right. And for those of us that are not in line with the Democratic Party, that is a scenario in which there actually is the ability to be able to have this kind of opening to open things up into kind of autonomous political territory, right? It's not that necessarily a Biden election closes down all those possibilities, right? As it normally would. Like when Obama got elected, I just remember watching attendance at political events just like drop through the floor almost immediately. Because people were like, cool, our savior's here. He's going to fix everything. And they stopped showing up, right? Anarchists were largely one of the few groups of people that were still on the streets and for most of Obama's first term, right? And what we absolutely cannot let happen is we cannot let that exact same thing happen with Joe Biden. Now, Joe Biden will come into office with far less legitimacy and far less of a mandate. But we cannot let this election suck all the energy out of what's going on right now. Because if we do, it's going to take a long time to rebuild that inertia, right? And right now, things are moving in a really interesting direction. And so if Biden gets elected, or if Biden is capable of being inaugurated, I think it is incredibly important that right away, even the first day, that people are out in the streets with that message, that just because you beat Donald Trump does not mean that you have a mandate to dictate everything that happens in our lives, right? That's not what people voted for. They voted for Trump to get out of office. And we need to make that very, very clear. If we don't, we're going to end up legitimizing Joe Biden, who, again, is the same person who is behind the 1994 crime bill, which largely led to the growth of mass incarceration in the kind of contemporary era in the United States, right? And that would be absolutely tragic given all of the work and pain and suffering that people have gone through over the last few months.
So before we get into the other stuff, real quick, let's not spend a bunch of time on this, but there was an article put out on It's Going Down. I know Peter Gelderloos has a response to it, which we'll be publishing soon. Probably by the time you listen to this, it'll be already be out. But it's about kind of initially Trump's push to attack the post office. Since then, he's, like you already mentioned, he's really doubled down on like, hell yeah, maybe I won't leave office. And even his like daily kind of debriefer person has like confirmed this. So let's talk about real quick. Where's that at on? Where are we at on the president maybe potentially not leaving office even if he's not reelected again?
Yeah. So it is very clear that he's going to make a move in that direction, right? Again, they admitted that yesterday during a coronavirus press briefing.
And to me, that signals he's prepping his base. Like, look, this is what's going to go down.
That's exactly what he's doing. Just as he's been spending time prepping federal agencies, right? This deployment to Portland was definitely a test. Now, is he capable of pulling that off effectively? Probably not, right? But that's not the question that I think is relevant here, right? The question is not, is he going to win, right? I don't think that there's any conceivable reality in which Trump somehow is able to outlast street protests and rebellion inside of the federal bureaucracy and potential impeachment attempts and all of this indefinitely. Like, there's literally no way. But that doesn't mean he's not going to try. And he actually has a lot of incentive to try. Not only does he have a base that is going to support him in that attempt, but if he does that and he's able to rile his base up enough, he actually gains a really interesting sort of position. And that position is he gets to negotiate his way out of this, right? Now, Richard Nixon did the same thing. Nixon, like, stonewalled congressional investigations, refused to comply with judicial subpoenas and so on, fired the attorney general, fired a bunch of people that wouldn't fire the special prosecutor. You know, he did all of those things. He did them out in public, just like Trump is doing. But Nixon negotiated his exit. And essentially what he said is, I will resign as long as Gerald Ford gives me a pardon. And so he flew out on a helicopter in that sort of famous scene of him, throwing victory V's up in the air with his hands, right? It is very, very likely that we're going to see something similar happen here. I don't think that the more that the election kind of proceeds, the more this process sort of moves forward, two things become very clear. One, Trump is not going to win. He's not even close. 538 has Biden up by 8.5 points, including in every single swing state that's relevant, including in a bunch of states that, you know, aren't even relevant for the Electoral College vote. And Trump is losing ground in that process, right?
So real quick, again, let's not spend a lot of time on this, but explain to us, he's up by that many points. What does that mean in terms of people are sending in their votes?
Yeah, so...
because a lot of people have said that there's this kind of, like, I don't know, blue drizzle or something. maybe I have the pee-pee tapes too much on my mind because, you know, apparently that is true according to his attorney in a new book. But this kind of, like, tendency of blue voters to send in their votes via mail, and that will take some time. So my question is it possible that even in those swing states he could lose... like, you know, the night of the election when we're used to kind of seeing the results, but it would take a while for the other votes to come in.
So there's elements of this election that are very different that actually give him the room to try and challenge the results, right? The first is he's been trying to delegitimize mail-in voting for a while at this point, right? We've all seen that. And a lot of people are going to vote by mail, not just traditionally in Democratic areas, but all over the U.S. Because of the pandemic, right? Lots of people are going to vote by mail. Now, Trump doesn't actually need to disrupt the election enough by disrupting the mail system. He doesn't actually have to make that effective enough to win the popular vote. All he has to do is make that process effective enough to call the tallies into question. That's it. So if the election is close, or even within 5 percentage points, he can say, oh, yeah, well, the mail system's broken, and that means my people didn't get to vote, and look at all the Democrats, and they did this, and they, you know, and he can make all these arguments because, on one hand, lots of people are voting by mail in a system that he is attempting to fundamentally undermine. On the other hand, what he's doing is he's been waging this discursive war against voting by mail, you know, pretty much ever since March. And so those two things put together allow him to muddy the waters enough to be able to say, I'm just not going to accept the results. Now, no one's really quite clear what happens at that point. It's never really been a thing before. And so what the prediction is in this article, and this is something I very much agree with, is that there will be mass protests in the streets, and those will probably be very confrontational, and people will get hurt, and people will go to jail. But at the end of this, I think that what we're going to see is we're going to see Trump negotiate some sort of way out of this, which involves him not getting indicted after he leaves office.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.